Hello, Soul Family, and welcome to the Soul Goddess Podcast. My name is Aishwarya. I am a mystic, healer, coach, and music artist. We are walking into a pivotal golden age on Earth, and it's time to cultivate the art and science of elevating your consciousness to extraordinary levels. Imagine having the most profound relationships, tapping into your divine guidance, embracing your true soul design, and unlocking supernatural abundance through your innate gifts. Those are the conversations we will be having twice a week, every Wednesday and Thursday, and we will have episodes that will nourish your spirit and expand your horizons. Don't forget to subscribe and become a part of our ever-growing soul family, and expect to meet incredible guests who will bring their unique wisdom and experiences to the table. And on other episodes, it will just be me and you. Remember, you're more than a listener to me. You are family. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Soul Goddess Podcast. Today, I have a really special guest, Sarah Payton. She is an author, constellations facilitator, certified nonviolent communication trainer, and neuroscience educator. She integrates constellations, brain science, and the use of resonant language to heal trauma with exquisite and warmth and warm gentleness. Sarah teaches and lectures internationally and is the author of 4 books on relational neuroscience and self-compassion, Your Resonant Self, Guided Meditations and Exercises to Engage Your Brain's Capacity for Healing, the companion Your Resonant Self Workbook, From Self-Sabotage to Self-Care, and Affirmations for the Turbulent Times, Resonant Words to Soothe Body and Mind, and the Anti-Racist Heart, a Self-Compassion and Activism Handbook, co-authored alongside Roxy Manning. Sarah, welcome.
Reading those book names aloud. It's like, I like those books.
Yes. We will put those links down below for all of those who are wondering, oh, I also like the names of those books and they sound good. So we'll put that down below. So today we are talking about how to change our minds to make them cozy places to live, because obviously, and I love this because, you know, I think there's a lot of, a lot of people think, you know, I'll just travel to a different country and I'll feel different, or I'll move house and I'll feel different, and I'll be around, you know, I'll change my whole social circle and I'll feel different. Maybe you might, but at the end of the day, we are in our bodies, we are in our minds. Wherever we go, we are going to have to deal with our bodies and our minds. And there might be external circumstances that some of the time make us feel better. And I'm saying that with kind of speech marks, but at the end of the day, we're going to, like, unless we really connect and work with ourselves, it's never, that's true freedom. That means you can be anywhere and you will, you know, feel how you want to feel. So I just wanted to ask you, you know, what is a cozy mind?
Well, a cozy mind is one where you wake up in the morning and you're like, oh, here we are, you know, just like a welcome, a sense of welcome. And you have a moment of quiet, and instead of madly looking for your cell phone in order to start scanning, you think, oh, sort of, isn't it nice to be alive? Now, we live in a complex time where people are really ambivalent about, you know, participating in the systems that are falling apart everywhere and repressing people and doing all kinds of strange things. So there can be ambivalence about the outer world. But what is it like if inside of our own brain we're like, oh, honey, of course. I kind of see it as a general kind of brain remodel. And of course, I loved it that you mentioned the body, because once we get the brain calm, the body goes, oh, I don't have to be anxious. I don't have to be tense. I don't have to be on alert all the time. I don't need to be hypervigilant. Now, some of us live in situations that are dangerous. Well, then we get to be hypervigilant, of course. But in those moments where there's not danger, we get to be calm. Our bodies get to be calm. They get to be loved. If they're still anxious from the experience of danger, then we get to be warm with them. So there's like a, it's like becoming our own warm parent that's just always like interested in what we're doing and supportive and helpful.
Yeah.
Technically, we're changing the brain's default mode network, which is the brain's automatic voice.
I think what I want to, because what's coming to me immediately is sometimes it's easy to be like that when you're in your own space or when you're in, you know, you wake up and you're in your cozy house. Hopefully you like that is how you feel about your home. And, you know, that part is fine. But what about how do we, can we keep our minds cozy when we are going out into the world, when we are going to work, when we are dealing, like maybe even situations that we're kind of like, oh, this is a little bit triggering or it's just activating a different response.
Yeah. Or if somebody tells us we've made a mistake, that's a big one.
Yeah.
That'll take you right down. In these cases where we're managing relationships with other people, sometimes with difficult people, then we need the voice even more. It turns out that the body does this really funny thing. The body has responses to the world, like it gets scared or angry or sad or lonely. And that causes the kinds of those feelings in the torso that don't feel good, like your tummy hurts or there's rumbling in your tummy or your breathing is constricted or you feel that heartbreak pain. Mm. It turns out that if the brain is kind of tending to the body and saying, oh, of course there's anger. Oh, yes, that makes perfect sense that you'd be scared right now. Oh, of course you're having a lonely response to seeing, you know, you could be on the bus and see an old friend that hasn't talked to you and you miss them. But, and it's, you know, it's been a weird one of those weird friend breakups. And you go, oh, hon, of course you're lonely. The work that I teach is to invite people to begin to create an accompanying inner voice that's always there. And that just creates a steady stream of acknowledgement and warmth for the self, which surprisingly then, you know, some people are worried. They're like, will this make me selfish? Mm. If I'm a voice inside of me that's tending to myself all the time, isn't that a bad use of resources? Shouldn't I be trying to, you know, take care of the world? Mm. And as we begin to experiment with it, we find that having such an accompanying inner voice just makes us more and more available to the world.
Mm, I love that. And you actually mentioned, you know, the brain's automatic voice. So what is the brain's automatic voice and how do we, you know, invite in this nice voice, this encouraging voice? I don't want to use the word nice. this encouraging and, you know, just a great ally.
Yeah. There was something about you using the word nice and then rethinking it that took me down a whole nother thing. So I've forgotten the beginning question.
The question was about the automatic voice and how we, and what that is and how we transition to this.
Yeah. We learn our automatic inner voice from our parents. A lot of people think that the way our parents treat us, that we then internalize that and carry it with us. That's true to some extent. But what's surprisingly even more true is that however our parents treated themselves, that's what we carry with us.
Wow. Yeah. That's a real light bulb moment. I've never heard that before.
Yeah. So my father was extremely kind. He was extremely kind to us, but he was not kind to himself. My mother was, she had dissociative identity disorder and she was very variable. She would do different things at different times. So my father was the more stable one in my family and more probably the one that I integrated more fully. But so then I have to deal with the cruelty that he had toward himself, the lack of compassion, the lack of mercy, the high expectations, the perfectionism, whichever parent we're closer to. And especially, it's especially true with daughters and mothers, because that tends to be such close relationships. We recreate our parents' brain. And then we have to upgrade it and update it and heal it. And so if I'm speaking to my father's inner voice of intense perfectionism, then I don't even need to say Sarah's inner voice. I can even talk to my dad's inner voice. I can say Leonard's inner voice. Are you totally focused on trying to keep Leonard safe in a difficult world? Mm. And then just kind of tuning in, we'll tune in and listen. And how does that voice respond to having being met with kindness, to having its needs guessed at, instead of being told it's wrong and to go away? Stop that, Leonard Jenner voice, go away.
Mm. And how, yeah, sorry, carry on.
I was just going to say, it's what people try, but it doesn't work.
Yeah. I'm just really interested in how we inherit this, because I know our parents can knowingly or unknowingly project a lot of how they feel onto them, about themselves, especially mothers and daughters. You know, there could be some stuff that they feel about themselves and they project onto their daughters. Do we inherit this through projection, or it's actually like a DNA thing, or it's a behavioral thing? Like, how do we inherit this?
It's a brain. It's one of the things that happens. So you and I have not met before. We're just starting to get to meet each other. We both have a job, but around the job, you and I are starting to get to know each other's brains just a little bit, completely unconsciously, because mm. that's what people do. Mm. And when I focus on you and give you my attention, my brain automatically begins to recreate your brain as best it can. Mm. As we sync, as we come into coordination with each other, we're having a conversation, we're in coordination with each other, we're listening to each other, our attention is shifting, you're paying attention to me, I'm paying attention to you. In those moments, it's very odd, but we start to recreate each other's brains. And with our mothers or our fathers, if they're the closest one, we're doing the same thing, we're paying attention to them. Our brain automatically begins to recreate their brain waves, their focus of attention, where the energy is going. When I'm listening to you, my brain is finishing your sentences before you finish them.
Wow. Our mouths. Why did we sign up for this?
So we learn, in some ways, we learn not to pay attention, because that makes us more sovereign. But as we do this work of making our own brain a sweet place to live, then what happens is that we get to have more choice about what we're recreating and whether it's impacting us consciously or unconsciously.
Mm. When you talk about recreating, is that kind of we are predicting somebody else's brain, or we are internalizing their brain and recreating of like what we think their brain is?
Let's see, what's a good metaphor? It's like I can't, it's hard to think of one. I was thinking of, okay, think of a weather map.
Mm.
And the weather patterns. If you were another planet and you were tuning in to our planet, then you would recreate the weather map patterns for that little moment of paying attention and tuning in.
Mm.
It's like the energy and information that flows in the brain makes certain patterns. Well, each person uses their brain differently.
Mm.
Each person has been differently affected by trauma and and each person has a way that energy runs and flows through their brain.
Mm.
In order to understand each other, we recreate that energy flow.
Mm.
So that, for example, when you're saying, and I'm focused on you, then there's a certain almost a sensation of my brain doing what your brain does for this little moment of time.
Oh, almost like a mirroring or like a matching.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. And is that to do with wanting to connect deeply with others or being attuned to our environment for survival?
We are made to be extraordinarily social. Social in ways that we don't even realize are there. For example, you and I are on Zoom, so we don't get to sit close enough to feel each other's body heat.
Yeah. But
we each have sensors in our skin that are specifically devoted to human body heat. If it's too hot, they don't pay any attention. If it's too cold, they don't pay any attention. If there's somebody who's got human body heat, human temperature range body heat, who's close enough for them to feel, they go, oh, there's somebody close by. None of us know this. This is happening on a completely unconscious level.
Mm.
And when we're with someone else and we feel safe, then our brain, it does all kinds of wonderful things. Our brain lets our body know we're safe. Our body lets our brain know we're safe. Our immune system changes when we're safe with other people. Our immune system shifts gears and begins to fight cancer and viruses. When we're not with other people or with other people and we don't feel safe, our immune system shifts to create the cells of inflammation to try to remedy any kind of injury that we would receive. Mm. So, yeah, so many things shift. The amount of oxygen that our red blood cells carry changes depending on how safe I feel. The safer that we feel together, the more each of our red blood cells carries more oxygen out to our body. We start to run on oxygen when we feel safe. We are extraordinary, and we don't think about it.
That's fascinating. I mean, when you said the oxygen thing, it just made me think, like, when I feel safe, I can actually just breathe and just be relaxed and take up more space and just be. And then sometimes when I don't feel safe, it's like I don't breathe, I don't take up space, I'm like this. So it's not surprising about the red blood cells, because my whole body will be like, actually, like, no. Mm. And does this also apply to animals as well, or like other, things? Like, I know with animals, I definitely feel safe and they really affect how, I feel. So is it just with other humans, or is it just like nature and animals as well?
I hope that you are loving this episode, and I wanted to just take a quick minute to give you something super exciting, a free ticket to the 25-day Finally Feel Free virtual retreat. This is not an ordinary event, it is a sacred global sanctuary designed to support, elevate, and celebrate your unique journey. Me and over 50 visionary speakers will be diving into the realms of quantum health and wellness, unlocking wealth through your natural gifts, exploring a new form of divine love, and elevating to higher states of consciousness to create and experience your soul destiny. Don't miss this beautiful opportunity. Sign up. The link is in the show notes below. And now back to our episode.
Well, the animals that we've, we kind of are connected to mammals, and the animals that we've created the closest relationship with over tens of thousands of years are dogs and cats and horses.
Mm-hmm.
And my body certainly relaxes when I get to feel my companion animal's warmth.
Yeah.
I was just looking at some research about dogs and and I was thinking about puppy dog eyes, about how dogs will make puppy dog eyes at you. I was like, how do they do that? And then several days later, I found a piece of research that shows that dogs, over the 30,000 years that they have lived with humans, have evolved control over the muscles of their inner eyebrow. And they lift their inner eyebrows when they're puppy dog eyes. And wolves don't have this muscle. This is something dogs have in response to us having facial expressions. And cats talk more when they live with humans than if they live all by themselves. They're responding to humans having dialogue. They're like, I want to have dialogue too.
Yeah. With the meows, all the different variation of meows. The long ones, the short ones, the high ones, the low ones. It's like, if you have cats, if you have animals, you actually understand their language. Like, they might not be able to speak, but I can hear the pitch of the meow. I have two cats and I'll just know, you know, I'll know. Even if someone asks me, what are they saying? I can't tell you what they're saying, but I know inherently what they're saying, and probably vice versa.
Yeah.
Wow. That is so fascinating. So I know you talk about something called the emergence circuit, and it's connected to sexuality. Is that right?
Yes. When Jak Panksepp was the founder of basic emotions theory, he was the fellow who said that we have different tracts of our brain tissue that are devoted to different emotions. So when we're angry, the energy and information in our brain travels in a different part of the brain. When we're sad, it travels in a different part. When we're afraid, it travels in a different part.
Mm.
So our brain has these different basic systems or circuits. And what he said was that our sexuality circuit is of a huge importance to humans, because it's the circuit that takes us from childhood to adulthood. It takes us from being a child in our family of origin to moving into our individual adult selves. And so so I often think of this circuit as the emergence circuit, like that our sexuality and our becoming of who we are linked in really extraordinary ways. And that our that we don't even have to be sexually active. People can be completely asexual. That's not the point. The point here is that everybody's got this a reproductive system that matures us, that brings us into adulthood. And in that bringing into adulthood, there are a lot of things that happen that make us as adults very different from our child selves. And who do we become as we emerge? So I love this idea of the linkage between such a powerful life force within us and each person's individual journey to becoming who they are meant to be in some ways.
And how can we best support ourselves? Like, is there a kind of optimum way to support that, or is it just it's different for everybody?
What would be the optimum way to support that? I don't think anybody's ever asked me that question before. I think probably this experience of having the warm accompanying inner voice is one that helps with emergence. Because as we have responses to the world and the voice says, oh, well, that makes sense. Of course you'd have that response to the world. And the voice can also have a knowledge of our whole life. You know, it can also say, in this moment, I wonder if you're being reminded of your second grade teacher. And maybe the person that you're having a scared response to, you don't need to be scared of, because maybe that fear belongs to when you were in second grade. The voice has the context of our lives. And that's such an interesting thing for a warm and accompanying voice to have a knowledge of our history and to be able to put the puzzle pieces together. And these things, as we go, begin to help us release something that I call unconscious contracts that we make. That we make agreements with ourselves, some part of which is known. So somebody will say, oh, when I was 8, I made a decision I would never cry again. So we know that part. That part's conscious. But what we don't know is the roots of that. Like, for the 8-year-old, who is she saving, or he saving, or they saving? Who are they saving? Who are they honoring? What are they protecting against? Who are they loving? So I'll never cry again can have so many different possibilities. One could be, I'll never cry again in order not to be a burden on my mother.
Mm.
Because it's so hard for her when I cry. Yeah. I'll never cry again in order not to be beaten by my father, because that's what he does when people cry.
Mm.
I'll never cry again in order not to be humiliated by my sister. Each of these different things has a different context and a different flavor and a different feeling inside. Mm-hmm. And so the warm accompanying voice that has a sense of context, you know, kind of goes along and becomes more and more aware. And as we do this practice, this devotion of self-accompaniment with an awareness of unconscious contracts, what happens is that our brain becomes more and more free to go where it needs to go.
Mm.
Just yesterday, I was working on something where I felt I would try to talk to people about something new I was learning about my health, and my body would kind of cramp up and feel really uncomfortable. I was like, what's going on? And I thought, and I tried to catch what was the conscious part of what was going on.
Mm.
Kind of prohibition against sharing information. I will not know more than anyone else.
Mm.
And then I thought, okay, what's my in order to? And a lot of times when people are little and they're smart, they get bullied. But when I was little and I was smart, my classmates were really sweet to me. They just liked me.
Mm.
They didn't care. They were just like, oh, it's Sarah. She's smart. So I was like, why do I have this prohibition? Because I recognized it from over time, like I shouldn't be smart, I shouldn't know anything. And then what I realized was that my mom had skipped me from kindergarten to first grade.
Mm-hmm.
And if I kept being smart, she might skip me to second grade. And then I would have to leave my community.
Mm-hmm.
So the contract that I had when I discovered the roots of it was, I will not know more than anyone else, so that I'm not torn away from my community.
Mm.
Wow, that makes sense for the first time. It's not about being bullied. It's about this phenomenon of moving child from place to place.
How do you
take a stand? So that was immensely freeing, because I was like, oh, I don't have to worry about that anymore.
Mm.
I can stop doing that. I can not worry about whether or not I'm smart. I can just know what I know and hang out with the people I love.
Yeah, that is so fascinating. And I'm so glad you brought up the inner voice again, because I wanted to ask a few questions about that before we talk more about these unconscious contracts and how you actually rewired from, you know, that realization and going to, yeah, moving forward from that. So with the inner voice, is it just one main inner voice that we're working with, or is there like a few voices that come to support?
Such a good question. Because what research shows is that the voice we wake up with actually is different from the voice we go to sleep with. So during the day, the default mode network voice changes. It changes in response to how much energy we have. It changes in response to whether we're reviewing a day and feeling bad about it, or whether we're reviewing a day and feeling good about it. It responds to trauma. It responds to the release of trauma. It makes profound differences with the release of trauma.
Mm.
When we're little kids and we have an experience that's too hard, mm. then it gets stuck in the brain as an unpleasant memory.
Mm.
And then the more unpleasant memories we have stuck in our brain, in the part of the brain called the amygdala, the more the default mode network, the unconscious voice, the background voice of the brain, the more it goes to the amygdala. So like we're continually, if the more trauma we have, the more we're continually being re-stimulated by our pain.
Mm.
As we begin to heal the trauma, as we begin to bring this warm voice to the little ones within us as well, to say, oh, sweetie, I wonder if you were scared. Then the amygdala starts to relax, starts to let go of the memories. A different part of the brain begins to hold the memories. Part of the brain is a context maker. It's like, oh. So part of what was happening in my little process that I told you about was I was going from painfulness to context. And this is a beautiful movement that happens for brains as they become less traumatized. As my friend Ogo Nguyen says, she says, this work changes our experience from traumatic memory into life experience. I also think of it, you know, with the Rumpelstiltskin fairy tale, that we're turning straw into gold.
It's so funny you said that, because as you were explaining that, I saw you like as like this brain wizard. This I saw a sense of magic. Like I was just like, when you're talking about the brain, you know, it was, yeah. I see things like that sometimes. You look like a magical brain person. But anyway, going back to that, that's absolutely fascinating. So, and then does this voice evolve with us? It's, you know, maybe in the beginning when we start connecting with this voice, it might not be so like that soft, but does it grow with us, or do we kind of shape the voice by the more we work on our trauma and like heal ourselves? How do we start connecting with that voice when we've never done this before?
The way that I started was with just one breath of self-warmth, because believe me, when I started about 15 years ago, I'm 60 now, so I was like 45, and I started to stumble across the stuff that I'm talking to you about today. I was like, oh my God, my brain makes sense. Then I discovered that I could do, it was Bonnie Badenoch inspired me. She's an author who wrote Being a Brainwise Therapist, an amazing writer and thinker. And she taught me to just do one breath of self-warmth. That was all I could do. Like I remember it was like a year before I could, and I couldn't do it every day. I was like doing well if I could do it once a week, do one breath of self-warmth, because the inside of my brain was a kind of Sarah self-hate fest, you know? I mean, I survived, was by being cruel to myself and trying to force myself to do things. So just one breath a day of self-warmth. There's a series of guided meditations on my website that are for free download that people can do that follows the journey a little bit, that like, you start with just one breath. You start with just one cell, being warm for one cell. You have to really decrease the difficulty level, because warmth can feel claustrophobic and suffocating, all mixed up with abuse and mixed up with manipulation. So you have to go really slowly to make it safe.
And I guess it's like, and I'm glad you said that part about when warmth is mixed, because, you know, if people have grown up in abusive households or just like that kind of stuff, it's like there could sometimes be warmth and then that voice could turn or change like without any warning. So it could be really scary to connect with that loving voice and that tone. You almost feel you start rejecting it. So yeah, like bit by bit, just connecting with it. And I guess then the end goal is to really get to a place where that voice is always with you, always kind of supporting you through everything, and that you now have more compassion for yourself and the world around you.
Yeah. And as you, what I've noticed is that like at about 10 years, then there's a pretty profound shift. And this resonating self-witness, this accompanying voice, actually starts to enter people's brains, their dreams. They'll be dreaming, and all of a sudden they'll have this voice with them going, if it's scary, they'll say, oh, are you scared? This is just a dream.
I know some people out there are like, that is just scary for me to think about from where I am right now. But obviously we need to rebuild a relationship with that voice. And it's interesting because I see this, maybe there's different terminologies or ways of seeing this. For me, it's like that voice is like my higher self or like my spiritual guidance, which is always with me, which is always guiding me, is like a part of me and soft. But obviously I've had to do certain things to get there. It hasn't always been prominent. And I think having listening to conversations like this actually just makes you have that intention and start connecting with all this different support that exists within you and not just outside of you. So just circling back to the unconscious contracts, which I really like that you speak about, because I know people talk about contracts with other people, like soul contracts with other people, but you're talking about unconscious contracts that we have with ourselves, like how you gave the example of child who's like, I'll never cry again. So how did you get to that awareness? You had that awareness when you were saying your story about just being smart and how if you were too smart, you'd leave your community and move down, go up in the grades. After that awareness, how did you integrate that?
Well, that was just like yesterday.
Okay, how will you integrate it? Because you have the blueprint, so how will you integrate it?
Well, I noticed like today that I feel less tense about our podcast. And I don't feel like, oh, I shouldn't be saying these things.
Good timing.
It's less of like an inner battle. My body's not going, we're not safe. Don't do it. Don't talk about it. Don't say anything. Mm-hmm. So there's more like emotional room to think about other things and to think about implications. And I mean, this is stuff I love to think about and love to talk about. So it's very sweet to be with you and to be talking about it and to not have the inner breaks. Mm-hmm. That happen when we're in the face of an unconscious contract. Whenever we're trying to do something and we feel those inner breaks, then we can know that there's some kind of inner agreement that we have, where we've gone out of integrity with some agreement that we've made with ourselves.
It's funny because I met a kind of unconscious contract version of myself, I don't know what to call it, today actually, which is about, it never lets me be happy in when I've achieved something or when I feel happy about something. It's always like, no, don't get too ahead of yourself. Like, don't get carried away. It might not last. Like, don't just, and all of that. And I've realized that when I read so many people's bios and sometimes I have interviews back to back to back. And then I kind of like feel good that I can just like talk for an hour with someone and then just read someone's bio. And then every time I get that thought, I start going, it's like I make a mistake. And it's interesting that you said that, because it's that contract of like, don't get too carried away. And it's like the voice is literally like that in my head. And then it just puts me back into, okay, don't feel happy about what you're doing. Just do it.
Well, now we get to bring together two of the things that we've been talking about and learning. We get to say, I swear, is this your mom's? Is this your mom's contract? Is this your dad's contract? Mm. Or is it yours? Is it a contract your mom had? Or is it yours? Because we'll recreate our parents' contracts with recreating their brains.
Is it just parents or is it with everyone close in your life?
Well, it depends on, I mean, some people are raised by their siblings or raised by their grandmothers. It depends on who's been close to you and important to you.
Oh, okay. So it's not like friendships in your adult life or anything like that. They can't.
No, we're thinking about like, because this, I have a friend I was talking to yesterday who said, there's a pattern of oppression of smart girls. And so then there can be even like a cultural prohibition, like that we're up against. Like, do we get to be smart and still belong? Do we get to be good at things?
It's like, don't get too good.
Now we want to know, in order to don't get too good, in order to And then you get to look and see, what's your in order to? What are the roots that you don't know? Who do you love? Who are you taking care of? Who are you not leaving?
And then that way you know, I'm sure it will lead you into all kinds, like your beliefs that you hold and like how, you know, it's just, I love it because you really get a chance to look at your kind of operating system and how just by tracking the voices and seeing like, is it my mom's voice? Is it my dad's voice? Is it how they spoke to me? Is it how they spoke to themselves? You know, and then you go to your unconscious contracts and like look at your life and see. And I love how you gave that kind of symptom of it when you're like, because then you can, or when your body starts closing, it's like, then you can catch it. Okay, what's happening here? And then follow that. What's my unconscious contract? So it's a really great prompts that we've learned today to really start looking deeper into ourselves, our relationship with ourselves, and how we can just break those unconscious contracts. And the last question I really want to ask you is, I think this was, because we've kind of gone, you know, bit of this, bit of that, but it's all tying together. I think this is to do with the emergence circuit, but how is it, like, it's surprisingly integrated with the actual emotion of disgust?
Oh, yes, this is such fun. So when we're, disgust is one of those other very distinctive emotions that we have. It's got its own facial expression. It's got its own vocal tone. It's got its own response in our body where we feel nauseated or tight or clenched or sick. And so it's so important, but it's protective against early onset of sexuality when we're little. Mm. And we are learning about sexuality and things like, oh my God, French kissing or something like that. We're going to learn a little. Mm. Oh, yuck. People put their tongues in each other's mouths. That's just gross. You know, yeah. and there can be a delight in it. And it's protective. Mm. Because we're not supposed to start down the road of sexuality until our puberty begins to move us, until the sexuality circuit, until the reproductive organs start to mature.
Mm.
And that then it helps us to become sexual at the right time. Mm. So when we're following our body's development, then it's a very easy transition on our brain. When we're forced to become sexual too early, if there's abuse or assault, then it actually changes the relationship with the reproductive system.
Mm.
Little kids who have been sexually abused go into puberty earlier.
Mm.
Our brain gets changed. Our body gets changed. We are profoundly changed by the harm we do to one another.
Mm.
Profoundly changed. So the movement from childhood to adulthood is supposed to have a certain arc. And disgust is protective of that natural arc. Mm. And then as puberty comes, we start to go, oh, French kissing. That sounds like it might be interesting.
It totally changes, yeah.
Naturally shifting in response to the hormones of sexuality, the hormones of reproduction that are coming and maturing us. And then we move forward. If we're lucky and we live in a world where our disgust is not taken away from us, because kids who receive harm have their disgust taken away from them, then we go into adulthood and we're like, I know what my no's are, and I know what my yeses are.
Hmm.
I know what I want, I know what I don't want. Hmm. But if we're little and somebody has put us in a position where we have to give up our disgust in order to keep their love, then we get up into adulthood and we're like, I don't know what I want. I don't have a clear no. I don't have a clear yes. So then a part of the healing is to reclaim our healthy disgust. It's quite odd. Feels a little weird to people, but it's quite healthy. It's quite good. It gives us a sense of like, yes, this is what I want. no, I don't want that. And that clarity helps with everything from knowing what we want to do in the world to whether we want, where we want to go to a what restaurant we want to go to for dinner, to what kind of person we want to spend our lives with. There's so many implications of reclaiming our healthy disgust circuit. So thank you for asking about it. I love to be able to tantalize and tempt people with the idea, because we're told so often as children, don't show disgust. Don't show disgust. It's bad. And so we give it up in so many ways. I love inviting people to begin to reclaim a healthy disgust, which is for ourselves. Politicians take our disgust and manipulate us to have disgust about people in order to be able to do the things they want to do. Have disgust about immigrants, or have disgust about people who don't have homes, or have disgust about people who are who have poverty, or and those things then allow us to be manipulated. Again, we need to claim it for our own selves, so we know our own yeses and nos. We aren't just accepting other people's imposed yeses and nos.
And that's so important to know. And for those of you listening that are thinking, you know, because I know it's a very conscious audience, very spiritual audience, and they might struggle with being like, you know, I'm not gonna like the word disgust and pushing away things or whatever. I think a way to start doing that and getting back in touch with your yeses and nos is just being like, tune into like what is for you today. Like, is this for you today? Just be like, it's not for me today. And then that just takes away all of the other, you know, if it's to do with food, oh, I just don't want to eat that today. Person, relationship, right now I'm thinking it's not for me. Maybe in the future it's for me. And then that's a way of just like softly getting into, yeah, like, what are you in this moment? What are your yeses and nos? Because otherwise, sometimes it can feel overwhelming to be like, oh my God, I don't know what, like, I don't know. So just start small and, you know, work your way up. And then when you get the confidence with like food or what you want to wear or like where you want to go, then you can start tackling the bigger things in life, like purpose and who's supposed to be in your life. So just wanted to put that note out. Sarah, thank you so much for this. This just really blew my mind. There were so many things that you said about the brain that I've never heard about before in that way. And just, you know, we covered the inner voice, how to connect with that inner voice to make our minds cozy. We discussed the importance of the sexuality emergence circuit and how it is integrated with the emotion of disgust. And also we delved into what our unconscious contracts that we make with ourselves are and how we can spot them in just everyday life and like work deeper to find the root of them and just rewire them so we are more of ourselves. So thank you so much. And what is, and I just wanted to ask you, like, what is next for you? You know, are you writing another book? Like, what are you up to?
This year, what I'm doing is running, I'm working on two books. One's a mystery novel with my sister-in-law. It's
really okay.
But the other one is about people who've taken the work, the understanding of relational neuroscience and resonance and this warmth into business. So I'm with a man who's used this in a large business and makes this the foundation of everything that they do. We're writing a book together in order to inspire people to live very differently, even in the business environment. So,
that sounds really exciting. And I think that's really going to, you know, create new pathways for how people do business, which is needed right now because the way we're doing business is very old. So that sounds amazing. And thank you so much for being with us here today. We will put the links to your website down below so people can actually access those free meditations and processes that you were talking about, and also the names of your books. And I'm guessing that they're available on Amazon and places like that.
Yes, or order them from your brick and mortar bookstore if you enjoy supporting local businesses. And find the meditations on my homepage at sarahpayton.com. Hit the Start Healing Now button and my email welcome series, And that will give you a free chapter from the book and take you through a bunch of free meditations, videos, and practice exercises.
Amazing. Well, thank you for that gift, and thank you for your knowledge and being here with us today.
Thank you, Aspire. It's lovely to be with you.
You too. Thank you for being here with us. Your presence here is a gift. To ensure you're always in tune with our latest explorations, subscribe to the Soul Goddess podcast so you're always notified of a new episode. Before we part ways for now, an exciting reminder to claim your free gifts waiting for you in the show notes. These are available for a limited time and they're crafted with love and intention just for you. Be wild, be free, and forever remain true to your authentic soul self. Until we meet again, sending you so much love and light.